We'll call the House Special Committee on Fisheries to order at approximately 10:22. For the record, we have in attendance committee members Representative Munoz, Representative Book, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Keller, and Chairman Edgman. The purpose of today's meeting, as I remind everyone to please put their cell phones in silence, the purpose of today's meeting is to hear two bills. One is House Bill 46, which is Representative Seaton's bill dealing with mixing zones and sewage systems. And the second is to hold the first hearing on House Bill 365, which is Representative Millett's bill. And I'd like to welcome the representative to the committee table. That's House Bill 365, dealing with fish processor fees and licenses and records. I'd like also to note that HCR 15, which was introduced by Representative Osterman, has been postponed because the representative was delayed due to weather in Kodiak, so we will take that up at some later date. And with that, not seeing any comments from committee members, let's get down to our first bill, which is House Bill 46. And if I could ask Representative Seaton to come to the table, please. We also have online Cameron Leonard with the Attorney General's Office for questions. And public testimony is closed. Just to note that for the record. Representative Seaton, did you want to make any sort of opening comments as we bring this bill up for the second time, knowing that we do have three amendments that will be under consideration here as well? Representative Book, did you have a comment? The record could reflect that Representative Johnson has also joined us, and welcome. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill actually asks three questions. One is, should the citizens have the right to know DEC information on freshwater pollution without having to file a Freedom of Information Act request? Secondly, should pollution above the state toxic standards be allowed to be discharged on freshwater spawning beds as mixing zones? And the third is, should neighbors have the right to a public hearing if a commercially operated sewage lagoon is going to be expanded over 50% in their neighborhood? And so those are the three questions before the Fisheries Committee. The biggest one, of course, is the mixing zone question. And that is simply for the, as we've seen before, mixing zones, again, are areas where we allow toxic pollutants to be discharged above the state standard. And all this bill says is you can't do that in a spawning area. That is the way the law was before 2002. All of the mines in the state, because it affects mines, were permitted under those situations. Donald Creek has been brought up. That was the one that was required to move its mixing zone upstream, I think it was 1,400 feet, away from the spawning area, and they were still allowed to be permitted and operated. So this bill has made sure that we exempt the problems with turbidity from placer mining operations, and it doesn't affect the other permits for in-stream crossings and those kind of things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. With those opening comments, any questions for the bill sponsor? If not, once again, public testimony has been closed. We do have three amendments before us, amendments 1, 2, and 3. And Vice Chair Clark, would you move amendment number one, please?
Yeah, I just want to say that all three of these have been explained in a previous hearing. And this is just to make sure that we all have the same document in front of us. I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. We also have Lynn Kent on with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Representative Seaton, amendment number one.
Thank you. Amendment number one adds commercially operated, where we're talking about sewage lagoons, to make sure that there wasn't a question that these were, private private disposal site for the person's own property.
Committee members, discussion? If not, I will remove my objection to amendment number one, and we will adopt amendment number one. Amendment number two?
I move amendment number two.
I will object for similar purposes. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number two is to page 3, following line 21, and inserts the definition of useful life. Means the anticipated time in which a facility can continue to be operated without replacement or major renovation. Just adding clarity to what is intended in the statute.
Okay. Committee discussion, questions, comments? If not, I'll remove my objection and we will adopt amendment number 2. Vice Chair Keller?
I move amendment number 3.
I'll object again for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number 3 is to page 3, line 5. After authorization, we're deleting the period and adding, or for an area where spawning was ongoing at the time of initial authorization, if that authorization occurred more than 5 years prior to the effective date of the bill. And this was added for some clarity for some rural villages that have sewage outfalls that haven't officially been permitted, but they weren't denied and they've been allowed, and so without a permit. And so this just makes sure that those ongoing operations are not affected.
Okay. Amendment number 3 is before the committee. Questions or comments? Representative Johnson? Not seeing any discussion, I'll remove my objections, which means that we have adopted amendment number 3 as well. That brings the bill before the committee. Not seeing any additional amendments as such. Committee discussion on House Bill 46. Representative Millett.
Thank you, Chairman Edgman. I've had a lot of time to sit and look at this legislation, and while I appreciate the sponsor's attention to mixing zones, and especially in spawning, critical spawning areas, I still have some large concerns about the change from the current mixing zone requirements to this, as it will reflect with small communities that aren't as developed and aren't as sophisticated on mixing zones and their development as they go forward in their communities. I think it is adds another layer of government. I looked at the fiscal note and noticed that we're going to be adding a full-time or part-time position, and I think that as it stands now, I think DEC is doing a good job with the statutes as they stand on mixing zones, and I'm still a little uncomfortable with some of the language in the bill, and I've spent some time with Representative Munoz and Representative Johnson talking about our concerns, and I'm still not to the point where I'm satisfied with what we have and some of the answers that we've received back. For that reason, I can't support this legislation at this time. I think that there needs to be some work done to it. While I appreciate, you know, the protection that you're trying to provide for spawning areas, I think that it still has some process to go through.
Representative Seaton, do you want to respond?
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Yes, we've worked with all the questions that we were given, and I think that it comes down to the question for the Fisheries Committee whether it's good public policy to discharge toxics above the standards that are established for the state for aquatic life on freshwater spawning areas. And those spawning areas are salmon when the salmon aren't actively laying their eggs, and that's all other just the named species, but only those that are making nests. So these are only nesting areas, and there have been no permits denied, no mines denied, because they weren't able to accommodate the resources, the renewable resources of Alaska. And we look at either subsistence fish or commercial fish, and we don't protect their spawning grounds. It is my feeling that we're making a trade-off, and trading away our renewable resources and our fisheries resources, in which all our communities depend, because this does not prevent anything. All it does is make modifications so that a mixing zone does not occur in the spawning area. It doesn't mean that there won't be mixing zones in rivers. It just means that they won't be in the on the spawning grounds themselves.
Did you have a follow-up, President Miller?
Through the chair of Representative Seton, while I appreciate your explanation of that, I think that what the legislation actually does, which I'm frankly uncomfortable with, is it makes us pick a resource to develop. It picks a winner based on onerous and maybe overreaching, far-reaching requirements on a group of people, namely miners, that have, in my walk around the state, have seen that they are doing utmost to protect all resources, you know, equally. I don't think that what we have here is going to allow allow permitting to go forward for some mines and not some other mines, and so I'm uncomfortable with that. I think that as we go forward with our statutory requirements to protect resources, that we need to protect all resources equally. So to that point, I think it's a little far-reaching, overreaching.
Representative Seton, I guess to further explore those comments, this bill is, I think it's the second iteration I've seen of it in my two terms here in the legislature, and this version has some safeguards built into it in terms of exemptions for municipalities, more placer mines, and of course the supposition, I think, behind Representative Millett's comments is that you would have a mine right next to spawning grounds, or some kind of industrial development right next to spawning grounds, where in reality, that's not always going to be the case, certainly, because a lot of industrial development does not take place near spawning grounds for salmon and so forth. But did you want to talk a little bit about some of those exemptions built in the bill? Because I know this discussion has surfaced time and time again about the concerns about the sort of the unintended consequences of the legislation vis-a-vis adding the protective standards in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess the best example is Donlin Creek Mine. Donlin Creek Mine wanted to have discharge, and they went for a permit. And this was previous to the Murkowski administration, which changed the status that prevented all mixing zones in spawning areas to allowing that. And they had to move their where they were going to discharge their material and move the mixing zone. And they moved it, I think it was 12 or 1,400 feet up to a boulder patch area where the mixing zone took place and where it wasn't in the spawning area. And the mine got its permit. The mixing zone's taking place. This doesn't even say you can't have something nearer there. It just says where you're going to discharge your water. You can't do it into an existing area. We also built into the bill in the previous version, which DEC has adopted, which was that if you dig settling ponds or create a channel and that is later invaded by one of the fish species, that can't be then reclassified as a spawning area. So if you make an artificial channel or artificial pond, that was one of the protections we built in there to make sure that we didn't have the repetition of what happened in Valdez, where they had a sewage lagoon that had a discharge, and they dug a channel that went out to the marine water, because this doesn't do anything on marine water, and that was later invaded by pink salmon. Just make sure that those kind of things can't happen. And so those prevention and those things have been built into the bill. There was a question with placer miners, because when you're mining, there's turbidity, which is, just mixing up the silt, and that's exempted in this bill as well, to make sure that we weren't looking at negatively impacting small placer miners, because, of course, silt is present in all our our waters. So those are some of the accommodations that have been made in this bill, and the question just comes back again, do we want to have toxic pollution above the level that the state has declared as being safe for aquatic life, and do we want to allow that water above those standards to be discharged in spawning areas? And that's the thing that this bill prevents. It says you have to discharge it in other parts of the river, not in the spawning area.
Comments or questions, Vice Chair?
A comment that you may want to respond to. The DEC has testified that they are unaware of any water quality damage existing regs, and that the regulations already prohibit mixing zones in spawning areas with the time element, you know, with the during the time that the fish are actually spawning. So to and take if I take that in the context of, in along with the unknowns related to what it's going to do, like for example to all the municipalities across the state, as their useful life of the mixing zones of the sewage treatment plants comes up, I cannot support the bill because I'm very uneasy with the unintended potential unintended consequences, you know, that could be really far reaching. And that's separate from the mining, just think about that, municipality.
Representative Seaton, did you want to respond?
Well, we had comments from municipalities and villages, and, you know, one of the amendments that you adopted in here made sure that we took care of that problem that D.C. had identified, that there were some things that they hadn't permitted. And so if those existing things were proceeding, that was one of the amendments that you adopted this morning to make sure that those unpermitted discharges that were a normal course in some parts of rural Alaska were taken care of. And the useful life exception there is, I believe, a really legitimate one that we should allow those. But when those facilities over time are so degraded that they can't be, they have to be replaced, then the replacement should be at a level of what we want to see for Alaska.
Representative Munoz.
Well, this also includes lakes. It includes species, Arctic char, grayling, brook trout, burbot, cutthroat trout, pike trout, rainbow trout, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very broad. And I think to the situation that occurred here in Juneau with the Kensington mine and the difficulty over permitting with the tailings disposal plan for the lakeside facility, laketop facility rather, and the difficulty that they had over the discovery of I believe it was trout that had been introduced. I don't believe that facility required a mixing zone, but it just it worries me that as difficult as permitting is in this state, that we add another uncertainty to the permitting process. And I would like you to speak to that, and then also to the Clean Water Act requirements that require analysis for changing water quality standards, and whether or not you've contemplated that with that with this legislation.
Representative Seaton.
Through the chair, first of all, you're right. The Kensington did not require a mixing zone. You're right that this includes these freshwater species. However, like grayling, which are this is the existing list that's in statute. Grayling, where they're broadcast spawners, you notice in the bill it's where they make nests. So it's not a nesting species, then it will not include them because it's only the reds, not which is the nest. So if it's a broadcast spawner that puts out, you know, eggs and sperm into the water, then we do not have the situation where that's prevented in that location because that's a moving location and you can't identify it. So I think that those are taken care of. There was some issues about the Clean Water Act and the notification public process. And 303C of the Clean Water Act does require public process, but that's for the triennial review, which is done every 3 years. And for the public process for modifying or adopting standard, it's just carried out as appropriate. And that's the exact language out of there. And that's 33 U.S.C. 1313C-1. So, and the idea that we don't change mixing zone requirements or allow mixing zones or anything is, I mean, we've done that. We've had recently the cruise ship initiative that came through, which was a statute, which was enacted. And we had a lot of money and interest there. And if that was an issue at all, that we couldn't do those things, they would have been suing on those grounds. So, you know, there's been some static flying around, but when you actually read what provisions they apply to, those public process for that is the requirement has gotten mixed up, because that's a triennial review requirement. People are, and we should have a very open and robust public process in the triennial review, but for changing the individual toxic pollution standards, there is not that requirement that you're talking about. And this is not changing the toxic standards at all. It's just saying, can you exceed those toxic standards on spawning ground? There is no change in the toxic standard. The toxic standards are there, and a mixing zone specifically says, we are going to give you permission to violate the standards. And we won't call it a violation, because we'll say if you mix it with a certain amount of water at the edge of that mixing zone, then it has to meet our adopted water quality standards. So I think there's been some confusion and application of those requirements to the wrong provisions. And so, yes, we've looked at it carefully and found that those weren't correct objections.
Any follow-up questions?
Well, just yes. The example of legislating, they're having precedent for legislation with water quality using the cruise ship example, that is proving to be a very, I can't even think of the right word, a very onerous and unscientific way to go about legislating water quality for that industry. In that it was done through legislation, addressed many of the problems that we're talking about with this legislation, I think. And when you legislate a change to water quality without going through a regulation process, then you are going to run into some problems, unintended consequences.
Representative Seaton?
Well, I would just say that, you know, that's exactly what happened under the Murkowski administration when they took away the standard that said you cannot have a mixing zone in a spawning area. Okay, we're just reinstating the requirements that were there previously. And so that's, you know, this isn't really rocket science. We're reinstating the requirements that the state had pre-2002.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Seaton, do salmon always spawn in the same area, or do they pick a type of area in the river to spawn?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, spawning areas are identified by Fish and Game, and they're in the rivers. They're pretty definite as to where they come back to. They will come back to a habitat type, but those habitat types are not extremely variable. In other words, where you have spawning area, you also have to have gravel, and you have to have upwelling waters so that the eggs stay fertile. So you're definitely not going to change from, like in the Donlin Creek, you're not going to have a boulder patch become a spawning area from one year to the next. And so that's why they moved their mixing zone to the boulder patch.
Representative Johnson.
So does water temperature affect that? Do they move around based on water temperature and...
Representative Johnson, through the chair, water temperature varies from year to year, and are we talking salmon, or are we talking, I mean, I don't know what we're...
Well, this salmon for, you know, just because that's the species we can deal with as spawning, so let's take that.
Sure. Representative Johnson, Fish and Game does have surveys of the rivers. They do have those things identified. You do have some species of salmon that are much more mobile, like pink salmon, that are located not up far up river systems, they're located fairly close to the coast, and they are much more migratory, and that's why we put in the requirement that if an area was invaded by fish at a later time after the permit was issued, the permit continues and does not change. So that if you have an area that is permitted, was not a spawning area, and then we made the accommodation in the bill so that became a spawning area later, you didn't deny or change the permit.
Representative Johnson.
And how far back would you anticipate Fish and Game going to say this has in the past been a spawning area, so it's not an invasion because they've been there before? Is it the previous year? Is it the previous 5 years? Are we basically, I guess to get to the point of my questioning, are we talking about eliminating a mixing zone in anywhere on a river that's a potential spawning zone based upon the invasion? I mean, what are they going to say? Well, if it's been there in the last 20 years, then it's a spawning zone, even though they hadn't been there in the last five. You can't do it. So are we basically excluding any place that could ever potentially be a spawning zone in a river?
Representative Seaton.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no. When somebody applies for a permit to have a discharge, there are findings that go forward right then, and they find out whether that area is a spawning area, not whether, you know, 100 years ago there might have been fish there, but whether that is a spawning area. And that determination is made, and then a permit is granted or not granted. People have to move their discharge pipe, or they can have it on the spawning grounds. But that would be dependent upon what is found at the time and what is determined in a permitting application.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, and I think that would be determined the definition of what is. Is it a spawning zone? Was it a spawning zone? Is it going to be a spawning zone? And I don't think this particularly addresses that, and I think it leaves it open for interpretation that everything that's a potential spawning zone is a spawning zone. And one fish in the area a spawning zone makes, and I think we're basically taking any habitat that could potentially be a spawning zone and eliminating it with this piece of legislation. And I have other concerns, but that's primarily one that I have on this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton, response. Let me just say that we also have Ms. Kent online with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I'm going to ask her in a moment if she's got any comments, but Representative Seaton.
Sure, and I just say that when somebody comes in for a permit, there's consultation with Fish and Game. Fish and Game determines whether it is a spawning area, not whether you know, a habitat type is such that it could become one. So I've never seen what you're describing offered in any testimony on the bill previously. So,
Lynn, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, did you, we've had a substantial amount of discussion here on a number of points relating to the bill and the amendments, but did you have any specific comments you wanted to offer at this point?
Certainly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple. What I would like to do quickly is run back to the references to the cruise ship law that passed and add a little clarification there. The cruise ship law that passed through the Citizens Initiative did not affect the water quality standards. It did address effluent limits from the cruise ships, but not the actual standards that we have in place for water quality. This bill, however, does make changes to the water quality standards, and that's because EPA views the mixing zone regulations as a part of the water quality standards. So Cam Leonard with the Attorney General's office is online, and I think he provided some information to the committee that was clear that this is a standards change that would have to go through the EPA approval process.
Mr. Leonard, if you're online, could you respond to that, please?
Yes, good morning. This is Cameron Leonard with the Attorney General's office, and I did send a letter last month answering a few questions on this subject, and at least three of you, I think, were addressees on the letter. But Ms. Kent is correct. Yeah, this bill, if it were enacted, I think would qualify as a water quality standard requiring EPA approval, and then there are certain requirements in the federal regs that would govern that process. But they're discussed in some detail in that letter.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, Section 303C2B, you know, which is addressed in that letter, is specific to toxic pollutants, and so it doesn't apply to the mixing zone requirement. And Section C, 3, and 4 are about EPA's approval and disapproval process. So, you know, it would be good, you know, we could put those things in findings, but I think we're talking about different things, whether we're talking about toxic pollutants or we're talking about the mixing zone and EPA approval process.
Okay. Ms. Kent, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, it's probably a Cam Leonard question there.
Well, if I may, I mean, I think we have a difference as to the law. I disagree with Representative Seaton, and I know from practice that any time DEC promulgates any water quality standards, whether it has to do with toxics or not, it goes through the same federal approval process. I think the applicable requirement of the Clean Water Act is probably 303C1 and C2A. It's not limited to toxics. It's any water quality standard goes through the same approval process. That's it.
Representative Seaton?
And I'd just say that, you know, these water quality standards, I believe, are actually the new ones haven't been approved by the, that they're talking about, haven't been approved by the EPA, so the existing water quality standards that we're talking about in this bill are actually, have been approved by EPA, or in existence.
Is there further discussion on House Bill 46?
I just
have Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Mr. Leonard?
Yes.
Yes. In the letter you submitted in answer to questions, you discussed the analysis required before a change is made. And in your letter, you stated that federal regulations require that a state seeking EPA approval of a proposed revision to water quality standard submit the following information: analyses conducted to support the standard, an explanation of the scientific basis for the standard, and certification by the Attorney General or other legal authority that it was duly adopted. And you go on to state that the sponsor of a bill proposing such a change to an existing standard should make the first two items available to committees considering the bill and to the public before a bill is enacted. Could you speak to that, please?
Yes, I would be happy to. Through the chair, those requirements can all be found in federal regulation. The citation is 40 CFR section 131.6, and it simply spells out what a state is required to submit to EPA in support of any water quality standards project. And then there's a separate regulation governing the hearing that is required as part of the state's promulgation of its standard. And it's in that other regulation where the supporting analysis that the state ultimately has to give to EPA also has to be part of what the public has before it prior to the public hearing. And so those are requirements that would be triggered by this bill, just as they are triggered every time that DEC promulgates water quality standards as regulations, which, of course, is the more normal process.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Representative Seaton, do you have any additional comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, we've had these water quality standards in place. You know, we've got new water quality standards that are being applied for, but you know, the prohibition on mixing zones, pollution mixing zones and spawning streams has been in place before. And so I think that if we had the authority to adopt those previously, you know, we're adopting what we've previously adopted in state law.
Okay. Any additional questions from committee members to the bill sponsor, to the department, both Department of Law and Department of Environmental Conservation? If not, I have talked with the bill sponsor, I think it's time to consider the bill before us. And you know, my closing comment would be that Certainly, I represent the fishing district. We've got the Pebble Mine in our backyard. There's concerns about a non-renewable resource encroaching on the, you know, the most valuable fishery in the world, salmon fishery. And I think my position is pretty clear on this whole issue. I support it. And, I think it warrants moving to the next committee to have additional discussion. I don't think the bill passes this session. I think we all know that. But in terms of continuing the discussion so that Alaska can be forward-thinking in terms of protecting our fisheries, you know, that's where I'm coming from. I know others around the table feel differently about that for whatever reasons. I'm not casting any aspersions or putting words into people's mouths, if you will. But I feel that, you know, that I wanted to offer those closing remarks. And with that, if there aren't any additional comments, I think a motion is in order. Representative Book?
I'd like to make a motion that this bill is moved.
Object.
There is an objection. Will the clerk call the roll?
Can I speak to my objection?
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I too want to protect clean water, but I think in a 90-day session, if we think a bill is good policy and it should be advanced and eventually become law, then we should move it out of this committee. We shouldn't move it out of the committee just because it can go someplace else, or we can divide cover. And so what I'm asking the committee to do is, if this bill has merit and you think it should become law and you want to see it on the floor and you want to see it on the books, then by all means pass it out of this committee. If you don't think it represents good policy and shouldn't become law, don't send it to the next committee under the assumption that it's not going any further. In a 90-day session, one of the things that we as a committee have to do is start making determinations and stepping out and being a little, taking a little fortitude and making decisions in committee and not just saying, oh, we'll let finance handle it. We'll get to finance and they'll kill it. And that's been the tendency of this legislature. In the era of a 90-day session, we have to have fortitude, but we have to make decisions on a committee level. There isn't time for us to move every bill to finance or every bill to judiciary or every bill to resources. It is time for us to make policy decisions on a committee level. And with that, I'm prepared to vote. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional comments or questions, Representative Millett?
Thank you, Chairman Edgman. And I think I appreciate my colleague to the left, who's more to the right of me, apparently. But I'm not going to vote for this bill. But based on, I don't think there's a deficiency right now in our water regulations. I think that, you know, this is far-reaching. I think the implications aren't known. When we talk about EPA standards and water quality standards, I sends up a red flag. I've been very vocal about my my objections to the overarching federal policies that have been laid on the state of Alaska on every aspect of our livelihood as a resource extraction state, and I see this as us doing it to ourselves when I don't see us having a deficiency right now in mixing zone problems. So for those reasons, I don't think that, I think that this isn't needed, because I think our water quality and our mixing zones, DEC has done a great job, and I think it would be a testament that I didn't trust them. I didn't think they were doing their job by passing a piece of legislation that's this. So for that reason, I won't be supporting the legislation either.
Any additional comments? If not, Mr. Representative Johnson.
And I appreciate the discussion, but I would move to table this. I think we need more information. I, you know, and whether we vote on it or not, if we could table it, if something new comes up, maybe we could vote on it. But I would suggest that we table this and not take that vote at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I object to that. Okay. I maintain my motion to move the bill.
So we have an objection to the motion to table. Did you formally?
There's already a motion on the table.
We already have a motion.
I was basically asking. Okay,
I'm trying to sort through this. So we
right.
We have a motion on the table, mm-hmm. to take action on the bill before us. And
excuse me, for point of clarity, doesn't a motion to table take precedent, though?
Does it supersede it? I don't.
I think it does.
It does too. Mm-hmm. You're the chairman.
Well, Let's stand out here for a second. Call the committee back to order at approximately 11:02. We have a motion before us. Representative Johnson, what was your desire?
Mr. Chairman, I would motion that we table this bill and not vote on it at this point, awaiting some additional information, and certainly am not wanting to vote down something that may have some merit in the future with some additional information. So I'd vote that we table this bill.
Given that a motion to table supersedes the motion to move the bill out of committee, is there objection to the motion to table?
I object.
There is an objection to the motion to table. You wish to speak to objection, Representative Booth?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr.
Motion
Chairman.
Motion to table is not debatable, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Booth. I think Reverend Johnson is correct, okay. But I will offer the floor to you to speak to your point.
But don't debate.
But not debate.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to Representative Seaton's concerns. I'm looking at this as restorative legislation, and that is my point of view, and that is what I'm going to maintain.
Okay, so we have a motion to table before us. Your objection is
maintained.
Representative Justin, you help me with this parliamentary.
Yeah, we vote.
Yeah, we
vote on tabling.
Okay. So will the clerk call the roll, please, on the motion to table House Bill 46?
Motion to table House Bill 46. Representative Millett.
Yes.
Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Book.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Keller.
Yes.
Chair Edgman.
No.
I have 4 yeas, 3 nays.
So the motion to table the bill is carried, and with that, House Bill 46 is tabled to a later date. Thank you, Representative Seaton. With that, we will turn the committee's attention to House Bill 365. Representative Millett.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Millett.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Therese Millett, House District 30 Representative. I'm here to present House Bill 365, which is a continuation of some work that started in 2002 for a fishing capacity reduction program that was passed by the legislature back in 2002, which is commonly known as a buyback. HB 365 is simply an accounting procedure modification to make the program operate more efficiently and to allow the lender to monitor the capacity of the reduction loan repayment. It does not change the program at all that was established in 2002 in any way. House Bill 365 will allow National Marine Fisheries to access confidential state records and report through an exception to AS 1605-815A. This is not an unusual request, since a dozen other exceptions have been granted under the statute, including the National Marine Fisheries, but for purpose of fishery management and enforcement. This legislation is necessary since the state of Alaska maintains the fish ticket harvest data and the fish processor annual reports. This exception will provide assurances to National Marine Fisheries that they are receiving the proper repayment of their loan. The original legislation in 2002 was supported by the Alaska fishing community and had overwhelming legislative support in both the House and the Senate, as it did as we modified it in 2006. This support stemmed from the fact that the program was initiated by fishermen and for fishermen. It is a voluntary program, and no one is forced to sell their limited entry permits. The program requires a majority vote of all the fishermen to implement the loan agreement program. The Fishery Association will have access to federal funds to the tune of $21 million through the Magnuson-Stevenson Fishery Conservation Management Act. There is little state expense or administration. The state maintains its responsibility to manage its fisheries in the future, and should conservation or economic conditions change, the program has had historic legislative support. So I would ask you to consider HB 365, and I also have Frank Homan here to answer questions. It's not a complicated bill. It's an administrative change, so we can continue to use what we started in 2002, so those permits can continue to be bought back and sustain a healthy and a vibrant fishery in Southeast.
Thank you, Representative Millett. Not seeing any questions for his bill sponsor. Mr. Homan, did you want to offer some comments?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Homan. I'm the chairman of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Thank you for the opportunity. I see you have a big crowd, so I won't take too much time, as I think it's good to hear from real fishermen instead of bureaucrats. But what I would say in echoing what Representative Millett said, that this is a program that was originated by fishermen. They came to the legislature and made their presentation. It's available throughout the state to any fisheries, but the Southeast Saners are the fisheries that put the effort in to develop an association and to go to Washington to seek federal funding for it, and to have discussed it amongst themselves to the point where they're comfortable with seeking a buyback loan that will be repaid by the fishermen over the next 30 years or whatever the actual contract becomes. So the thing that is significant to know, I think, is that it's a voluntary program. It only works in regions where the fisheries come together and want to do this. The Southeast Seine fishermen have in the last decade only been fishing about half of the number of permits because of costs and mostly for low prices. That's changing somewhat, but when you look at the total fleet of about 380 boats now, it was 416, but they've had a pilot program a couple of years ago with some federal grant money that they were able to reduce it by 35. And these permits are ones that are not fished, and that's a significant, I think, in that half of the fleet is not fishing. So it's an opportunity for those remaining to take the chance with the future and to buy out those permits not fished, which would enable them, those remaining, to improve their economic condition in the future. So with that, there's probably more comments behind me here, but I'll end with that unless there are questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Holman. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I support buyback programs, but I have a few questions. One would be the permanence of such a program, given the constitutional access, and so we buy back 10 years, I come in and I sue the state saying, you're not using this allocation properly, it's been locked up, and it's, what is the confidence that this can be a permanent buyback and we're not just going to get into a cyclical, you know, where the market comes in and, you know, it looks like the market's doing some things now with half the fish not being permitted. And so how do we ensure permanence of these buybacks, I guess, is my question under our constitution, the way it's stated.
Mr. Holman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think one of the features that that we should remember in here is that while this is being undertaken, the state still maintains its responsibility to the fishery, and it has a feature in the Limited Entry Act that if things in the future change, that there's an opportunity for the state to come back into a fishery and analyze it to see if things have changed enough to change the situation. And it's a feature that that the Supreme Court has actually encouraged, and that's a what we call an optimum number study. Right. If sometime in the future fisheries became too exclusive, in that those that were remaining in the fishery appeared to be reaping a major economic benefit that was out of proportion to the fleet's activities, the state could come back in and analyze that, and it has the opportunity, sort of a safeguard for the state, to issue more permits into a fishery after a careful study. The safeguard that went into this program was in 2006. There was legislation passed that said, in the unlikely event that that would ever happen, that the proceeds from the state selling more permits into this fishery would be used to pay off any loan balance. So it kind of protected the people that are in the fishery, but still the state maintains its ability to manage its fish in the future.
Representative Johnson, follow-up to that?
I appreciate that, but the state statute of 2006, you state, doesn't trump the Constitution. It doesn't trump the Constitution, which says that, you know, we have rights to the resources, you know, they're owned by the people, and there are other things that would allow for someone to go in and once again, I really support the buyback program. My concern is the permanence of it, and are we going to be in, once again, I just don't see anything short of a constitutional amendment that can guarantee that, and we don't want to go there because then we set up privileged groups, and I think we have some of those fisheries at this point that are getting very close to that. And then if, when the state goes in and says, well, we need to open this again, have we set up a false economy that subjects ourselves to lawsuits, you know, and on down the road? And we know that those 265 or 300 people that are going to be in that situation of, they consider making good living, there's going to be some people out there saying they're making an extraordinary living off of the resources. And so we're going to be, the state's going to be caught in the middle. And what I want to make sure, or ensure, at least put on the record, that that is a concern and that we need to address it. And I don't know if we can, but I certainly want to protect the resource and make sure that you know, fishermen can make a living and that there's plentiful resources. But I just want to make sure the permanence of these buybacks, if we can even do it, and if not, I'm still prepared to go out on a limb and take that chance, because I think legally we can make it work. But I just want on the record, we can't guarantee anything here in terms of limited entries for, I mean, the courts are going to end up deciding probably.
Mr. Holman?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're absolutely right that whatever issues come over limited entry, the courts will decide, and the courts have been very active in this arena. over the years. I think the it's the change in a fishery that would cause this to happen are significant, and that it's not I think it's not in view in the future that that's the change would be such that you'd want to add more permits into it, but the statute I think would have to be significantly changed, and the court would have a significant role if you didn't allow that to happen, allow a mechanism for more permits in a changing situation. I think the court would see that as a overreaching limitation, but that's just my opinion at the time.
President Johnson, follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that, and I applaud the group that's brought this forward and quite honestly fought fairly hard to get where they are with it. But the model that we put in statute is one that we need to be able to transplant into Cook Inlet, Bristol Bay, you know, all the places. When we don't want to create a law that's specifically for an area. So even though it's a very solid plan with a well thought out proposal for the southeast, how would this move to Cook Inlet or Bristol Bay or some other place? Because I think those are some areas that are probably maybe even more distressed with more pressure. Maybe they're not as collegial as the southeast group is to be able to work together. But these are things that we're going to need to put into those areas and have them work there as well. So can you kind of address, if you took this model and put it in Bristol Bay, or took this model and put it in Cook Inlet, what would it look like?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the program excuse me, is available to any other region at the moment. It would be those regions forming a fisheries association under the state statutes and seeking a comprehensive group from their fisheries to proceed with this. The Southeast fishermen went to Washington, D.C. and got some federal money. That avenue is available to any other group formed under this legislation. There's other methods that they could use that are not quite as rapid, and that is to assess themselves up front and collect that money until they had enough to buy permits back. But that's a much, much longer process when we're looking at 30 years to pay back this loan. So that the program is available now to various groups if they have the core that see the need to do this, and they have the permits, unfit permits that might be an opportunity to reduce the fleet.
President Johnson,
I think I have some more questions, but maybe it's still a concern. I think it's one we take the chance on. I support the program enough that, you know, I've never been one to oppose fighting something in court if I think we're right. So I think this is a good program. I just want, for the record, to know that we are looking at something that is potentially not as permanent as I wish it could be. I wish there was some way we could do that, that we could buy those and own those and not have to worry about those future things. But I just don't see it without a constitutional amendment that would be major changes. But I do think it's important that we look at that and consider that. And I, for one, am prepared to take that chance and applaud the group for bringing this forward. And I think they should be a model for the rest of the state. I think it'd make everyone a much happier camper and protect the resource and protect Alaskan families.
Okay. With that, not seeing any more questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Homan, we also have four questions. Representative from the Department of Revenue, Tim Cottingen. Tim, are you here in the audience? You're in the very back. Did you want to make any comments on the bill at this point? Just available for questions then? Okay. With that, I don't think we have anyone else at this time. Next, I'd like to move into public testimony. We have a number of individuals who traveled to Juneau and are here in person today to testify specifically on House Bill 365. So with that, we'll just start at the top of the list. hopefully I get your names spelled right, and when you do come forward, if you could identify yourself and any affiliation for purposes of record keeping, and if you could, so we get everybody in, maybe try to limit your testimony to several minutes. And with that, we would start with Brad Haynes. Is that Brad, you want to come forward and correct me if I've missed to pronounce your last name and put yourself on the record?
Howdy. My name is Brad Haynes from Ketchikan, Alaska. I'm a purse seiner, a fourth generation commercial fisherman. Started running a sand boat when I was 18 years old, and I support this bill. Basically, I'm putting a tax on myself that I'll probably be paying, you know, one of the longest of anybody in the fishery now at this point, you know. So it speaks for some itself right there.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Haynes. Any comments or questions for Mr. Haynes? If not, thanks for coming forward, Brad.
Thank you.
Next, we will go to Brian Bankman.
I'm Brian Bankman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Bankman. I come up here from Washington. I've been fishing, seining in Southeast for, well, since 1973, and I bought a permit, started running a boat in 1981. And the fisheries evolved quite a bit since then, but in the 80s and 90s, it seemed quite overcapitalized. And then in the last decade, the numbers of fishermen has dropped dramatically, and it just seems like it's a very good time to pursue this buyback. Any time in this decade would have been a good time. I think it's overdue, but it just seems like it's the perfect opportunity, because we're not really going to buy people out of the fishery. What we're going to do is stabilize the fishery where it's at, and as it improves, we might benefit from a more viable fishery economically for the people involved, and it won't suffer some of the problems we had back in the previous decades of overcapitalization. And so I support the bill. I think it's a great time to do it.
And Mr. Bankman, you're representing yourself.
I am a member of the Southeast Alaska Seiners Board.
I'll ask others as they come forward to testify to identify whether you're representing yourself or you're representing an organization. So just for, again, for record keeping purposes.
Okay.
Any questions for Mr. Bankman? If not, thank you, Brian, for coming forward.
Thank you.
Next, Seth, and I'm not...
it's Wyman.
Wyman?
Yes.
You must be a doctor or a lawyer or... No?
No. No, I'm not. I'm actually a commercial fisherman.
Okay. I figured it's that. I'm looking at your handwriting.
Yeah, it's not very good. That's part of that. I'm a commercial fisherman in Southeast Alaska. I'm on the board of the Southeast Alaska Seiners. And like Brad, I'm one of the younger people in the fishery, so this 3%.
Seth, are you representing the board or are you representing yourself?
Right, both.
For both?
Yeah.
Fine.
Both. We're willing to tax ourselves 3% for the life of this loan to make this fishery a little more stable, a little more beneficial to all of us. So that's really about it. I think this bill is a good bill. I think it'll help a lot of people. So
okay,
that's it. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Wyman? Not seeing any. Thank you for coming forward, Seth.
All right. Thank you.
Next, we will have Sven
Struzman.
I guess commercial fishermen have bad handwriting too.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Sven Struzma. I'm a representative of, or a member of the Southeast Alaska Seiners Board, and I'm representing myself and the Southeast Alaska Seiners. I'm from Washington State. I also I support this bill. Obviously, it's to maintain the economic viability of the fishery for ourselves, and I have three sons. I hope to maintain it for them as well, should they choose to participate in this fishery, which they are so far as on my boat. And I support that.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Struzman? If not, Sven, thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak. I'm Vice President of Southeast Alaska Senators. My name is Randy Stewart. I'll be representing myself and the association. In talking with different representatives and folks yesterday, there seemed to be some concerns about that this might cause the price of permits to go up and restrict access to the fishery for new members. And thinking about it over the evening, and I mentioned it to a few yesterday, but I don't really see that. I know when I started fishing, I started in 1977, right after the buyback happened, and even then, it was much cheaper to get into the fishery, but I still needed help. I needed to convince somebody else to finance me into the fishery because, as a young person, I didn't have enough money to do it on my own. So one of the very, the fact that limited entry came that limited the amount of competition for the resource from the commercial end was a huge thing that had just happened that stabilized the fishery at that point in time. That said, okay, we can look at this. This is the amount of competition that we have for the resource. This is a very stabilizing thing that's just happened. So we don't have to worry about buying in, looking at these economic parameters, and 2-3 years from now, we got a couple hundred other guys that we're competing with. And so this is what I look at now. This is not really, even this is not going to raise, if it did raise the price a little bit of a permit, the permit value is a very small portion of the value that cost to get into the fishery. The vessel equipment nets is much huger than the cost of a permit. And if somebody, anybody that's a young person that's going to try to get into the fishery now is going to need help. There's just the cost of becoming a commercial fisherman is too high for any young person out of college or out of high school or whatever to do on his own. He's going to have help. And so people that are going to help him are going to look at the stability of the industry, the stability they're going to co-sign their money to support this person. And I just believe that, you know, with a couple hundred or 170 permits that have been out there that are dead that could possibly come back, that's a very unstabilizing factor to look at for a young person to get into the fishery. So this is one of those stabilizing things that will do. I'm also 55. I don't know how many more years I got left. I got a bad back and sciatic. I'm hoping that the fishery will look successful enough that someone will want to buy my permit here in the future. And so that's another thing to look at. I don't want to try to build a fishery that's exclusive that no one can afford to buy into. I want it to be a profitable industry that somebody is willing to take the chance to borrow money to get into it and make it their own business. So, and I think that this bill will do a very major part in stabilizing that picture for future entrance into the fishery. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stewart? Not seeing any. Thank you, Randy. Next, we'll go to Dan Castle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Castle. I'm the president of Southeast Alaska Saners, and also, so I'll be representing myself and the association. Additionally, I'm a board member of the Sane Revitalization Association, which was tasked with building this program 10 years ago, finding the money, and figuring out how we could get the job done as far as extinguishing all of the latent permits that are lying around out there. And the program's looked a lot, you know, we've had a lot of ideas, we've kicked around, and we thought maybe there was a state program that might work, and that didn't turn out to be true. We have the funding now through National Marine Fisheries for the loan program, and it's just a matter, this bill is just a matter of a collection vehicle to take the money that is awarded to the fishermen each time they make a delivery and delivered to pay back the loan. And so I guess we're simply viewing this as a payback mechanism, but I understand that it's the final piece to the whole buyback program, and for that reason, I guess it gets jumbled in my mind because it seems like a simple operation to just collect the money and pay the people that we owe, but it does need to be, it does need the blessing of the state of Alaska, I guess, and I would appreciate it if you guys would adopt the bill 385 and move on down the road. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Castle? Not seeing any. Thanks for coming forward, Dan. Bobby Thorstenson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Thorstenson, Executive Director of Southeast Alaska Seniors Association. I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my constituents. This, you know, at first blush, it's, you know, certainly a housekeeping bill, but it's a very, very, very important piece and almost like the final loan document to a long process, which I think had perhaps the board had somebody else move from Seattle Juneau to work on this, it might not have taken an entire decade, but it's been like a jobs project. This is why I moved to Juneau in 2003. The permanence issue, an optimum number issue, we dealt with as best we possibly could without having to deal with, you know, the court issue is, if you do a permanent an optimum number study today, next month, if market conditions change 1 or 2 cents, or if one permit leaves or one permit comes in, the optimum number is reshuffled. So had we done an optimum number study anywhere along the way, we would have just been doing a series of optimum number studies. And I agree with you through the chair, Representative Johnson. We would desire to be able to deal with that optimum number in a different manner. That's a risk we're taking with a 3% loan. All we have is the 2006, where the legislature may reimburse the Revitalization Association, not shall or will, or you may, of course. That's all the reassurance and comfort that our folks have that are going to be paying the assessment. There's hopefully you guys have some of the information, background information from CFEC, Commercial Fishery Entry Commission. The first round was 35 permits. The percentage of non-residents was in the 80 plus percent range. Systematically trying to eliminate the non-residents. It just so happens that most of the non-residents tend to have the latent permits. So we've looked at like the statistics on a town like Petersburg, which currently has 13% of the permits. After we complete the fleet consolidation, Petersburg will have 22% of the permits. There's a couple other points I'd like to bring up. I guess that this has been supported by the Alaska State Legislature. You guys sent us on a mission back in 2002 after you had the Legislative Task Force, Salmon Task Force, and we've been working on this for 8.5 years. And finally, after the last 3 years working with the National Marine Fisheries Service Financial Services Division, they flew back to Juneau in early February, and this is the language that they needed to secure a loan of up to $21 million. Thank you very much for your time. I know there's other folks to speak, but if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Question for Mr. Thorsten, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Bobby. In 2002, did the processors support moving forward with the buyback program?
Yes. Actually, in May and June of 2003, we received support letters from every major processor that does over 10 million pounds in Southeast Alaska. Trident, Ocean Beauty, Icicle Seafoods, Alaska General Seafoods, as well as the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. And I understand there's some trepidation in the processing sector now that, you know, prices got a little bit higher for the last couple of years. We've been averaging about 15 cents probably, you know, as low as 8 cents and as high as 20 cents. In the last 2 years, we got 30 cents and 40 cents. But these are cyclical type of swings. I mean, in my 33-year fishing career, we've had 7 swings up all the way to a buck when I dropped out of law school to go commercial fishing. And we've had 7 swings down to a nickel. And just because the price is 30 cents today, and it may be 30 cents tomorrow, doesn't mean it's going to be 30 cents the next day. As well as the processors supported this. You know, I think there's some school of thought out there that you know, if we have a weak run like we had in 2006 and 2008 in Southeast Alaska, where we only harvest 15 million or 10 million fish, that we throw another 100 boats or another 50 boats from Seattle or California on top that will somehow catch more fish. It's not a very, I believe, a responsive approach, a responsible approach to the resource. Once we get the number to a level which the processors agreed it should be at back in 2003, if they decide to change their mind, I mean, they're certainly more than welcome. People can change their mind on any host of issues, but we've had full support and blessing to go out, pursue the program, and then just as recently as last month, I guess, or last 6 weeks, I've heard that some folks that supported it prior, you know, don't support it now. Well, you know, we're 8.5 years into a process. Would have been nice to have alerted some folks earlier if you had changed your mind.
Okay, any additional questions?
Thank
for
you.
Yes?
Just one.
Just a follow-up?
Will the buyback have any effect on existing active permits?
Well, in Southeast, for our program, it won't. And there will be no active permits removed unless a person decides they're at a certain age that they want to sell or they want to change their careers or do something different. They're certainly welcome. Other regions and other parts of the state, you know, I think the legislation is a one-size-fits-all legislation. You know, it's a way to have we've already accessed the federal loan grant program, and we've got a $3 million grant. We've already spent that money. Now we're accessing the federal loan program. We've got the access. We've got the congressional authorization. We just need to have the place on the fish ticket and have you guys pass this bill to do that.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bobby, I have a question for you. If this bill passes, you work very hard on it and call it a jobs bill. If it passes, will you move back to Washington?
I can't make any promises, through the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. Keep him here and others that don't.
No,
so.
I will not be moving back to Washington.
Will it help you get support for the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No. Thank you, Bobby, for coming forward in that nod of commitment. next, we will have, is it Niels Nebel?
Nick Nebel.
Nick Nebel, okay. Nick, would you come forward and put yourself on the record, please?
My name is Nick Nebel. I'm from Ketchikan, Alaska. I'll be representing the Seiners Association, also myself. I'm a Seiner. You don't want to follow Bob. No, I guess, you know, when you go to high school and you graduate and you start liking fishing, you're in. There's no way to get around it. But the state of Alaska let us, through the Commercial Fishermen's Revolving Loan, gave us access. Because everybody needs help. It's an expensive fishery. It's hard to do. And I used that loan from 84 to 94. I used, I crewed, and then I became a permit card holder. And I've seen the ups and downs. And this bill here, I hope, and I will bet on it, will stabilize the ups and downs. We'll make it a more smoother person for the next guy. And that's, you know, we're taxing ourselves and we believe in him. And, you know, other than hopefully to be able to keep fishing and having family wage jobs in this industry, I think that's where we're at. I mean, that's what we're hoping for. That's what we're swinging for now.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Neville. Any questions for Nick? If not, appreciate you coming forward and offering your comments on House Bill 364. Bruce Wallace. Bruce, are you in the back there somewhere?
Good morning. My name is Bruce Wallace. I'm a resident now of Juneau, and I'll be representing myself. I started fishing in 1970, and I bought one of the first permits in 1976 when the limited entry law came into existence. I've existed in the fishery since then in just about every form and way that you could do it, administratively, management-wise, processor-wise in a number of instances, not very successfully. I've seen the range that we operate in, and I would love to have a certainty, as Representative Johnson spoke to. The fact of the matter is that we don't have certainty, in most aspects of the fishery. On the biological side, we have the ability to produce enhanced fish, which we do, and I'm a member of a board that controls some part of that. We also have very good management. But those two things in and of themselves don't control the biology of the fishery that well. What we have the ability to do is control market to some degree. We're doing that in a number of instances, I think, and many of the fishermen have participated in those actions. My sense of this is that this closes a promise that was inherently made in the limited entry law. We started out in Southeast Alaska presuming to have something on a target goal of some 300 plus permits. By the time the legal actions had taken place, we were at 416 or 419, and that's an artifice that was never really there. There really wasn't that kind of fleet. But yet we embodied it, and we took that because it was a stability. This is sort of bringing closure to that stability, and it's a process that this segment of the industry, the purse seine in Southeast, has spent a decade trying to get through. It does have the blueprint aspect to it, and it is, as Bob said, a one-size-fits-all, but it also is the first hack that was a very tough road. And the fact that the fleet has stayed with it for a decade, I think, speaks to the general acceptance within the fleet. And I would ask your support for what is a housekeeping issue on one hand, but a very important piece of closure on another. So if your support can be given, I would certainly appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Any questions for Bruce? Thank you for coming forward. Is there anyone else here in the room who wishes to testify on House Bill 365? We have two hands raised. Can the gentleman in the very back come forward, please? Offer your name and your affiliation for the record.
Actually signed up, but I guess
I didn't see your name. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Haynes. I'm a lifelong resident of Ketchikan. One of the first tasks I remember doing as a potential seine operator was going in front of the business community of Ketchikan in 1974, lobbying for limited entry. Because we were successful at that, I had to buy a permit in 1975. But I thought at the time, I felt pretty strong. It was a great tool to help stabilize our fleet and help us get back in line what we needed to get to. Like I said, I've been running a boat since first time I was on bridge in 1974. Bought a permit in 75, started running a boat in 76. Been doing it ever since. I feel very strong that this is also another tool in the toolbox that would be a great asset to us, as limited entry was. And I think it's a great bill. Thank you.
Okay. And sorry about the confusion about your name. I do see a couple more names here on the sign-up sheet. Any questions for Mr. Haynes? Not seeing any. Gary, thanks for coming
Thank
forward.
You.
Scott McAllister.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Scott McAllister. I live here in Juneau. It's been a kind of walk down memory lane here, listening to a lot of my peers talk about their history in the business here in Southeast Alaska. And I'm representing myself here now. But it's Bruce Wallace said one thing that really kind of struck a nerve. This kind of closes a deal that was implied in the original Limited Entry Act. Originally, the way I understood it, there was optimum numbers and maximum numbers, and maximum numbers came into being due to the grandfather aspect of everybody who qualified for points should qualify for a permit. But it was never, and it was always assumed that there was the possibility for buyback. Well, we saw years ago, me and many of the gentlemen you've heard speak so far, that we were nowhere close to an optimum number. And commercial fishing is really, it's two words. It's one act. But this, to me, preserves the commerce in commercial fishing. Fishing is one thing we all do and we love, and there's a number of ways to do that here in the state. And the Board of Fish provides the opportunity for all user groups to do it. But, you know, commercial fishing is in competition with all the other elements and aspects of fish extraction in this state. And at some point, there's got to be a balance and a stability for the future for the commercial aspect of what we do. And I think that this really does kind of close that implied deal in the Limited Entry Act, that there would be the possibility of achieving the optimum number within a fishery and have a future, stable commercial future for the participants in that fishery. So accordingly, I support this, and I thank you very much for taking it up in consideration.
Thank you, Mr. McAllister.
Thank
any
you.
Questions for Scott? Not seeing any. Thanks for coming forward. Jerry McCune. Jerry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. I'm not going to take too long. You've probably heard all about the bill. We support the bill. I sit on the restructuring panel for the Board of Fish, and then I also was involved in sitting down with everybody with the legislation in 2000. One thing I heard from fishermen and groups that we made very sure of that makes UFA very comfortable is this is a volunteer thing. You can't force anybody out of take their permit or force them out of the fishery. So it's upon a group to take this up, and there's many ways to do it, and the Southeast Senators decided to do it this way. There's a couple other ways you can do it too, but UFA is very comfortable. The Seas Board decided to go ahead with this, and they have to get a vote from all the fishermen, so UFA supports this kind of effort. We never knew if we'd see one of these bills used or not, but here we are with seeing one used, so I'm kind of curious to see how it's all going to work, and hope they have success.
Thank you, Mr. McCune. President Munoz?
Thank you, Jerry. How long would it take for a permit unused to be considered latent?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, is that right?
Munoz,
yeah. I've been practicing that, but I must have missed it.
You've just become latent yourself.
I'm out. You're losing votes, Jerry. There goes my permit. Well, I would say that probably, you know, if you haven't, everybody takes a year off from maybe an injury or something, you know, but you have to renew your permit every 2 years. If you look at the records, and if a person hasn't fished in 4 years, then they're probably sold their boat or don't intend to fish or something's preventing them from fishing. They don't have a market or some circumstances to keep them out of the fishery.
And Representative Munoz, I'm looking at the chairman of CFEC, and he seems to be nodding his head in accord with that answer.
Oh, that's good. I won 1 point.
He may be sleeping.
Oh, I apologize.
You are just a comedian tonight.
Dragging anchor. Any additional questions?
I'd like to say one more thing, Mr. Chairman. I guess I got to do cleanup, you know, on this deal, so I got to head all these seniors. So I get to cork them.
Spoken by a true Gilnetter. Is there anyone else in the committee room who wishes to testify on House Bill 365? We do have one person signed up. And with that, we will go to Mitch Ide. Mitch, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It's Mitch Ide. I'm from Petersburg, lifelong resident. I'm a Saner. I'm representing myself and the board. I'm the board of directors of Southeast Saners. You know, my colleagues have said everything that really needs to be said. I just like to say that I support this, and I can't think of a younger fisherman in the fleet that doesn't. We all realize what this means for our future. And that's why we're willing to spend the next 25 years paying a tax to ensure some sort of stability. So I'd just like to urge the committee to pass the bill out, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mitch. Any questions for Mr. Ide? Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on House Bill 365? Not hearing so. Public testimony would be closed at this point. It's the chair's intent to hold the bill over till the next committee meeting, which is Tuesday, and at that time to bring it up with intent to move it. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone who came here today to testify in person, and the committee's business is concluded at 10 to 12.